This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Scandal and the Olympics. These two things seem to go together. This week, we've seen the What Turned the Water Green controversy and the What's Up With Those Marks on Michael Phelps' Back mystery. Television viewers asked why American gymnast Gabby Douglas didn't put her hand over her heart during the national anthem. And Facebook went crazy for about a minute and a half over why one Ukrainian gymnast took zeros in all his events. But what's it like to be in the middle of one of those controversies?
Well, my name is Corey Cogdell Unrein. I usually go by the hyphenated last name, and I compete in the sport of international trap shooting.
Corey Cogdell Unrein's name is at the center of this whole thing. But before we talk about that, let's go back to where this story began. Last Sunday.
Sunday was amazing. I was fortunate enough to win my second Olympic bronze medal, and it was just such an incredible day. The weather was difficult, made for some difficult conditions, and I was able to overcome all of that and walk away with the bronze medal, so it was amazing.
This is Corey's third Olympics for Team USA. She also won bronze in 2008. She's been shooting competitively for 15 years, and she's turning 30 in a couple of weeks. So that means she's been working at her sport for half her life. She's only been married for the past 2 years, but that's where the Chicago Tribune chose to put the focus when they tweeted about her bronze medal win on Sunday. The Twitterverse was not amused.
Actually, my husband texted me and he said, "Oh my gosh, have you seen what's going on Twitter and social media? People are talking about you and, you know, kind of going crazy." And of course, I immediately, you know, looked up what had happened and tried to figure out what was going on.
Well, so the tweet was, "Wife of a Bears lineman wins a bronze medal today in Rio Olympics." And before we get into what other people think about that tweet, what do you think about it?
Well, you know, initially when I read it, you know, I didn't really think much of it, to be completely honest. It didn't, you know, come off to me as something that was intentional or malicious. I just kind of thought, well, you know, they probably could have chosen a better, you know, heading to, you know, alert people of my victory.
Like maybe a tweet that included the words Corey Cogdell Unrein. Corey laughs about it now, and she laughed about it then, too. So did her husband, Chicago Bears lineman Mitch Unrein.
You know, he would actually send me some of the comments that people were making, saying, "Oh my gosh, look at this one. This one's funny. Oh my gosh, like, this guy nailed it." One of the ones that I thought was really funny was something to the effect of, "Husband of Olympian tries to make Super Bowl team." I sent that to him, and he got a kick out of that. He's like, "Yeah, that would be really funny."
I think the one I saw was "Husband of Olympian can't win Super Bowl." It was a little harsh.
Right.
On that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, "Oh, well, that's kind of harsh." But I mean, he's just one person. He's not the whole team. So he can't really control the Super Bowl win.
On Monday, the Chicago Tribune sent out another tweet saying that Corey Cogdell Unrein is, quote, "awesome on her own." We focus too hard on trying to emphasize the local connection Cogdell Unrein has to Chicago, the paper admitted, before promising to do better next time. The paper didn't respond to our requests for an interview. Corey says she appreciates that the paper admitted it was wrong. Wrapped up in all of this is the fact that for 2 weeks every 2 years, winter and summer, news organizations are in the business of reminding their audiences who's who, and we use shorthand more often than we'd like to admit. This one has asthma. That one grew up in a war zone. Sure, identifying a woman by the accomplishments of her husband is really annoying, but is it any worse than the headline CNN recently ran ahead of next month's Paralympics, "Blind Navy Veteran Hoping for Olympic Gold"? The Chicago Tribune made a mistake, but Corey Cogdell Unrein and her husband, I'm going to skip saying his name this time around just for fun, are doing just fine.
I'm a little bit used to living with my husband's fame, and he's used to living with mine. So depending on the situation, sometimes I'm the center focus and sometimes he's the center focus.
It helps that Corey's originally from Alaska. The NFL might rule Chicago, but it doesn't rule the 49th state.
Everyone back home was very excited, and the media up there has done a great job about, you know, focusing on me and what I've accomplished over my career.
While researching the story, I found another interesting tweet. It's a photo of the Chicago Bears in their locker room at training camp. It was taken after the team gathered to watch Corey Cogdell-Unrein compete in Rio. They're all wearing matching T-shirts to show their support of Corey and all that she's accomplished. Fewer people have seen that tweet, but I think it's worth mentioning. What happens when perfect turns out to be, well, less than perfect? That's the challenge the sport of gymnastics faced a few years ago. The man who first took on that challenge helped to change the sport and the way it's watched by fans today. And no matter how big a gymnastics fan you are, you probably don't know his name. But Bill Littlefield does. Before he left on vacation, Bill prepared this story.
This could be the highlight of the compulsory event. She is one of the technically strongest, best gymnasts that I've ever seen.
She is Nadia Comaneci, and 40 years ago, at the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal, the tiny, slender Romanian gymnast was preparing to wow a worldwide audience. At the Games in Rio, gymnasts will once again be among the brightest, most celebrated stars. Some of them will no doubt earn appreciation similar to what Nadia Comaneci received in 1976.
Watch this. Beautiful rhythm, right to a handstand. Oh, look at that amplitude.
Kind of makes you wish you'd been there, doesn't it?
Gorgeous routine, beautiful, and the crowd loves it.
But no matter how spectacularly they perform, no matter how much appreciation they receive, none of the gymnasts in Rio will earn what Nadia got, a perfect 10. Which is not to say that on that day at the Games in 1976, Nadia Comaneci didn't deserve that score.
For her time and for that day, there was no one better, and no one could have done it better.
That's Hardy Fink, and he should know. He was one of the judges that day. It was his first time judging an Olympic competition. Fink is also a former gymnast, and he's currently the director of education programs for the International Gymnastics Federation. But even as he was judging Nadia and finding no reason to deduct even the smallest fraction of a point from her performance, he was convinced that the perfect 10 was a flawed number, and that the digits below it had problems, too. That conviction began when Fink was still performing as a gymnast for Canada and watching his more accomplished competitor, Iso Kenmutsu of Japan.
He was so far ahead of everyone else with what he could do, and just in pure difficulty, the first triple twist on floor and this incredibly complex horizontal bar routine he did without any intermediate or intervening small elements.
Flourishes didn't count extra. In those days, the idea was to fulfill the required elements without making mistakes.
I could do the minimum requirement, and if I performed perfectly, I would have got a 10. And he did so much more than me, and all he could do was get a 10. He couldn't even get a 10.1 to show he was better than me.
Fink thought that was unfair. In fact, he told me he thought it was insane. And just a few years after Nadia's perfect 10 made her the darling of those 76 Olympics, Fink was proved right.
The 80s saw this tremendous spike in 10s.
Devorah Myers writes about gymnastics. She argues that the 10 was doomed by the proliferation of allegedly perfect performances.
The difficulty really, really escalated in the 1980s. And what I think happened was that, you know, the judges were, in a sense, searching for ways to reward the innovation, but all the scores are capped at 10.
Sometimes, as in the men's finals at the 1981 Gymnastics World Championships in Moscow, the judges backed themselves into awarding 10s.
I remember finals on pommel horse. Hungarian head judge, Hungarian gymnast went up with a routine that everyone knew could be beaten and received a 10. First guy up on pommel horse, and then almost everyone that went after him in finals was better. So there was 10, 10, 10, 10. In 88, we had a three-way tie on pommel horse again with 10s. So it, you know, became a stupidity.
In response, Hardy Fink, who says he loves math, came up with a system that would, among other things, reward more difficult routines. Fink explained his and subsequent systems to me in much greater detail, but the show's only an hour long, so my summary will have to suffice. Anyway, the International Gymnastics Federation allowed Fink to test his system on the junior men's competition in Canada, but that was as far as it went.
Well, it was abandoned because ultimately the FIG at that period of time decided, you know, through a vote, not to adopt it. This matter had been resolved, and they were going to keep the 10.
Maybe that was in part because in an imperfect world, people watching gymnastics or anything else like to feel they might see something perfect. But Hardy Fink had kicked the door open, and as the 10s continued to mount up, they became less and less special. Eventually, inevitably, as Devorah Myers explains, the system was rejiggered into something resembling the Fink model.
A gymnast goes up, and they're going to be judged for two different things separately. So they're going to be judged for the difficulty of what they're doing, and they're going to be judged for how well it's done. So in the case of Simone Biles, her vault is worth a 6.3, and she'll go and do it. And one panel of judges makes sure that she does that vault and gives her the difficulty credit for it. And the other panel, starting from a 10, takes deductions based on how well she does it. Those two scores are just added together.
That's the way it will work in Rio, but don't get used to the particulars of that system. Hardy Fink doesn't know how long it will last.
My guess is it'll continue for maybe two more cycles at most, because it's also going to collapse under its own weight. I don't think the rules have become more complicated as much by necessity as by short-term quick-fix decisions that always had unintended consequences that then needed another quick-fix decision. So kind of the Band-Aid approach.
So perhaps the best strategy for spectators who are unlikely to entirely understand the scoring is simply to watch, sometimes with their jaws on their chests, and let the judges worry about the numbers. Because when I asked Devorah Myers, who has written a book titled The End of the Perfect 10, whether there might ever emerge a stable, permanent system for evaluating what those gymnasts can do...
I think it's gotten more stable.
She thinks it has, but she doesn't know. And Hardy Fink doesn't know either, and who knows more about it than he does. And you know what? It's not going to interfere in the least with my admiration for the way those women and men perform on the bars, the beam, the rings, the pommel horse, or the floor in any way whatsoever.
In case you had trouble recognizing the voice, that was Only a Game's very own Bill Littlefield. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. The Olympics have taken over Rio, but there is still, surprise, surprise, other sports news. There's even a Major League Baseball season going on. And that's where we'll begin this week's three stories you should know. Joining me are sports writer Eric Malinowski via Skype and the Toronto Star's Morgan Campbell. Hi, guys.
Hi, Karen.
Hey, I love Boston.
All right, Eric, what is this baseball story that's been distracting you from all the swimming, tumbling, and cycling?
Yes, baseball is happening, and for one player, baseball will no longer be happening, and that is Alex Rodriguez. This is kind of a shocker. I mean, it was really just barely a week ago that the Yankees announced that Alex Rodriguez would be effectively retiring in about 1 week's time. And that's it. And we've bid A-Rod adieu. It's been an incredibly compelling career, an incredibly controversial career. I mean, he was so hyped and he was the number one overall pick. And everybody kind of thought, oh, you know, he's going to follow in the steps of Ken Griffey Jr., who, again, he was also a number one pick and played for Seattle. And we just talked, you know, on this show a few weeks ago about how beloved Ken Griffey Jr. was. That was not the case with Alex Rodriguez. You know, I think he was very guarded. I think he was one of these people that very much kind of wanted people to like him. But I don't really think that we ever got the sense that we ever kind of really knew the true A-Rod. And that's kind of a shame.
One thing we forget about Alex Rodriguez, if we rewind to like 2006 or 2007, and it becomes clear that Barry Bonds is juiced. And Barry Bonds is going to break all the home run records. And all the old hard-bitten baseball writers who like to play the game the right way kept saying, well, we can't wait till Barry Bonds retires because then Alex Rodriguez is going to come along and break all his records clean. And remember, this was the sentiment Right?
Oh, what and we then, knew.
Yes. And then the Alex Rodriguez first steroid scandal hits, and all of a sudden the whole trajectory, not necessarily of his on-field career, but definitely of his off-field esteem, changes. And I found that fascinating. And we just assumed that he was clean just because Barry Bonds was dirty. Like, because Barry Bonds is dirty, this guy must be clean.
And it's interesting because we did enter into an era where it's okay to say, oops, I doped, I'm sorry. But that's not what he did. And so I think a lot of people still sort of have grudges against him for that. Eric, I love that you brought up Ken Griffey Jr. because that just immediately brings up things that A-Rod and Ken Griffey Jr. did not have in common in my mind, which includes Ken Griffey Jr. did not play in New York, where the fans really, really expect brilliance. And more importantly, Ken Griffey Jr. did not, as far as we know, have two paintings of himself as a centaur in his house.
I mean, it's a mighty big assumption, but I think we could safely assume that. You know, the other thing is that Ken Griffey Jr. never won a World Series. Uh-huh. And Alex Rodriguez actually had, you know, one of the great postseasons in 2009 that we've really ever seen in the modern era.
Okay, enough of this baseball stuff. Let's turn back to the Olympics. Morgan, what do you have for us?
What do we have this week? So a story you should be on the lookout for. It hasn't been written yet, but I can almost guarantee it will be written probably within minutes of the end of the men's 100-meter final Sunday night. And the story is this. It's one of two. One, how would insert sprinter here perform in the NFL? Or two, how many guys in the NFL could beat insert sprinter here in a 40-yard dash or a 100-yard dash? Newsflash, Americans. By and large, the guys sprinting in the Olympic 100-meter final are faster than everyone in the NFL. I hate to shatter your dreams, but I'm comfortable in saying that there is not a single person that could beat Usain Bolt, Trayvon Bromell, Justin Gatlin, Andre DeGrasse, not on a field, not on a gravel track, and certainly not on a real track.
You know, what I think is interesting is that I think we're actually going to see something a little bit of a reverse trend now. If you're talking about NFL and Olympic sports, I was looking it up, and apparently on the USA Rugby 7 team this year, you know, rugby is now back in the Olympics.
Yes.
There were three former recent NFL players on the USA Rugby team. If anything, maybe the narrative is going to change a little bit. Maybe it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to think about speed. Now that we have sort of a football analog, maybe it's going to be a little bit more about sort of the physicality and things of that regard.
For me, this really isn't about track and field, and it's not about football. For me, it's about how we dumb down how we consume the Olympics, you know? And NBC here in the States, Morgan, has blamed this on the largely female audience that they say doesn't really like sports. And they're more interested in the journey than the outcome. And no, really what it's about is they want to be able to air their stuff in prime time. So everything's on tape delay and they have to make it all about the drama. And I kind of liken it to Bambi, right? Like we can watch Bambi 1,000 times over. Yes, we already know what's going to happen. We know Bambi's mother is going to die, but we're going to cry. And we seem to like that. And that's how NBC approaches the Olympics, right? Like, oh yeah, we know that you already know that Michael Phelps won this race, but we're going to make you cry about it, and that'll make you keep watching. And I just think that all of the things that are wrong with the way that we cover the Olympics come down to that.
I'll forever think of the Olympics now as gut-wrenching Disney movies from the 40s and 50s. my mind has forever changed on this.
And I've seen any number of blazing hot takes about how all these NFL guys could beat Usain Bolt over 40 yards, and they never come from women. Don't blame women for this.
Fair point, yeah. So I'm thinking about Olympic golf. The headline in Golf Digest reads, "Golf in the Olympics finally resumes 112 years later, tears shed." And I am shedding tears of boredom, because I think that golf is boring. But more importantly, it's back in the Olympics because sponsors love it. Sponsors love the access to rich people, and apparently rich people like golf, go figure. But let's think about it logically. Rio did not have a championship golf course. They had to spend 6 years building one. They had to fly their security staff to the United States so that they could learn how to handle security at a golf event. They had to bring in 4 dozen volunteers from outside of the country to work the event. And then some of the biggest stars in the sport didn't even bother to show up. They say it was because of Zika. I say it's because there's no payday. The Olympics are ruinously expensive. We say this all the time for the host country. And the IOC is supposed to be making it cheaper. And instead of making it cheaper, they're adding golf, which makes it more expensive. What we really want is more swimming, gymnastics, fencing, track and field, all these sports that we only see every 4 years. So I say we can watch golf any old time.
Yes, because the other thing about golf is that, and especially at an Olympic Games in which pollution is such a strong undercurrent, these stories about the pollution in the bay where the open water swimming takes place, is that golf is also like such a water-intensive sport and a land-intensive sport. It just adds to the waste and to the negative environmental impact of an already unhealthy games.
Well, you mentioned, you know, bringing in all of these volunteers to help because nobody really knew anything about golf. Clearly, they should have used that headcount on bringing in volunteers that knew something about pH levels in swimming pools. I think that probably would have been, you know, a better use of resources and headcount. For me, I'm just kind of looking forward to 2020 when we get surfing in the Olympics because, you know, that will be sort of like a little bit more – like if we're going to talk about like sports that like maybe kind of don't belong there but we're willing to give a shot – I'm so in on surfing, really not so much on golf.
Until the first country has to build their own waves.
We'll take these problems one at a time, but I'm willing to at least give that one a chance.
My guests for 3 Stories You Should Know have been Morgan Campbell of the Toronto Star and sports writer Eric Malinowski. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, I'll admit it, I love watching old newsreels on YouTube. This one features long-distance swimmer Greta Anderson as she prepares for the 1959 Channel Race, sponsored by an English businessman named Billy Butlin.
Twice already, she's won the cross-channel swim. If she wins again this year, the trophy will be hers outright, says Mr. Butlin.
Greta didn't win the race that year, but Butlin let her keep the trophy anyway. Long-distance swimming made Greta Anderson famous, but hers is really an Olympic story. And like many Olympic stories, it involves challenge, adversity, and more than a little luck. Reporter Susan Vallett talked with Greta in her home in Orange County, California.
Greta Anderson's home is dotted with mementos from her storied past, framed ads featuring Greta for things like vitamins, motorboats, and swimming pools hang on the wall. And tucked away in a corner of the living room, a glass case filled with silver trophies, including a giant cup for winning that race across the English Channel. Next to that trophy sits a petite gold medal on a gold chain, a reminder of a life a long time ago.
Sometimes you have a talent and you don't know it before you start working on it.
Greta was 12 years old in the spring of 1940 when Nazis took over her native Denmark.
I still remember the airplane coming over. They were dropping all kind of pamphlets, and they said, "You are occupied by the German. You don't have a king anymore. We are in charge." That was pretty horrible. They didn't like the Jews, and we had Jews living where I was living, and I can still hear them coming up the stairs and taking down the people and putting people up against the wall and just shooting people just in front. I saw it. They just shoot people and they don't care. They were very nasty. At 12 year old, you kind of don't really realize how bad it is. You just realize that, oh, God, this is strange. They're shooting on the streets.
Greta's brother was a decade older than her and a freedom fighter, part of the Danish resistance movement. The fighters would get into battles with Nazis, shooting from windows on upper floors of buildings, including in Greta's hometown outside of Copenhagen.
One time my dad and I was right in the middle of a big gunfight, and we stayed right in the middle of the road, and there was shooting from the windows. And my dad said, "Stay in the middle, stay in the middle, don't go to the side." We didn't get shot. We made it, obviously. Yeah.
During the war, Greta's parents were worried that German soldiers would rape her, so they dressed her like a boy.
I didn't like I had to wear boys' clothes. I remember that, and they got my hair cut. Now, all of a sudden, you have to wear pants, and boy's shoes and short hair. So I was dressed like a boy for 5 years when they were occupied us.
German forces surrendered in May of 1945 and withdrew from Denmark.
And I can still see them walking out with all the belongings they stole, all the bags and all the clothes. And we were yelling at them when they walked out, the damn Germans.
After the occupation, Greta's life started to return to normal. Her dad decided that she should learn how to swim. After all, she lived in a country almost entirely surrounded by water.
I was 16. I still couldn't swim. My dad tried to teach me, but I had a big inner tube on, and they were just making fun of me. I didn't want to get out of the inner tube.
Greta's dad eventually got her out of the inner tube at the local community pool, where she attracted a different sort of attention.
There was a swim coach there. Her name was Elsa Jacobsen. She was one of the best swimmers Denmark ever had, and she happened to see me swim, and she made me swim 50 meters, and I didn't know how to breathe, so I swam the 50 meters holding my breath. She said, well, you got good lungs. We have something to work with.
Jacobsen started coaching Greta in her own time, and Greta began to swim with the local club team. A month or so later, she placed third at the European Championship, her first swimming competition.
In 1 year, I was among the best three in the world, and then I became the best in the world. I guess I had the talent.
Soon, Greta was making plans to swim for Denmark at the 1948 Olympics in London. This was the first Olympics after the war, the first Olympics in 12 years.
And I got special privileges because I was the best one in Denmark at that time. I didn't go by boat because they didn't want me to get seasick. Oh, I remember. So the coach and me got to fly to London.
And when she got there, it was a celebration with dorms and arenas filled with people from around the world, happy.
It was fantastic. It was fantastic.
Denmark was expected to do well, with Greta leading the charge. She had the best time in the world in the 400-meter freestyle. But she was due to start her period, and team advisors were worried that would affect her performance. So they gave her a shot to try to hold it off. To this day, at nearly 90 years old, Greta still doesn't know what it was. But it didn't hit her until she was in the pool, swimming her best event.
And of course I was in the leave, and then I just fainted. I know they put me in this room and next to the pool, and I woke up. And what happened? I don't remember what happened. I fainted. But I would have won that 400 meter. And because of that, they didn't put me as an anchor of the relay. They were afraid that I would get sick again. So they put me second. We were going to have the gold medal and the four-time 100 relay. And, of course, we lost to America with one-tenth of a second.
Greta's misremembering. They actually lost by four-tenths of a second. Greta did win gold in the individual 100-meter freestyle.
When I won, they pulled me out of the water and made sure to help me put on the red pants and the white sweater, the Danish color of the flag. So I probably still have my wetsuit underneath and my hair was still wet. They pulled me right up. I was standing on the podium, and it was a very wonderful feeling. The Danish flag go up, and they were playing the national song. And behind me was the English king and queen. Oh, of course, it was wonderful. On the train home, it was all down with the windows and wave. And every train station had, I don't know, thousands and thousands of people. They were just, hello, welcome, gold medal. And it was a big thing, you know. I really didn't expect it, but it didn't take long to get used to it. I got tired to stand there and wave and wave and wave. I remember one of the swimmers said, let me help you. So she put on the uniform and waved because I couldn't lift my arms anymore.
An excited mob filled the streets outside of Greta's home, the same streets where a few short years before German soldiers had executed Jews. She got so many flowers that she ended up donating them to hospitals around Denmark because they wouldn't fit in her flat. That feeling of fear, hiding as a boy during the war, gone. Greta moved to the U.S. She got married and found even greater fame as a long-distance swimmer. But nothing would compare to the 1948 Olympics.
When I think back about it, it just seemed like another lifetime. It changed my life. It changed my life.
For Only a Game, I'm Susan Vallett.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports in PR style. Next week on the show, the past, present, and future of Olympic tattoos. I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a boxing gym in Detroit that teaches a lot more than hooks and jabs. But first, since Bill's away this week, I'm going to talk with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
American swimmer Michael Phelps entered the 2016 Olympics as the most decorated Olympian of all time, and he's added a bunch of medals in Rio. He says he's really retiring this time. Will you be sad to see him go?
You know, I pay attention to swimming like most Americans once every 4 years. So, yeah, you know, come 2020, I'll be saying, where's Michael Phelps in this race? It should be pointed out, though, that now he is not only the most decorated Olympic athlete of all time, he's the most decorated Olympic athlete of all time. He went sailing by Leonidas of Sparta, who was the original record holder for number of times winning Olympic events. That record stood for over 2,100 years.
Wow. Who else have you been watching in the Rio Games?
Well, I mean, I liked the performance of Daryl Homer, the fencer from New York who won a silver medal. You know, really the first individual medal by an American fencer since 1984, but that was a boycott game, so this was even more impressive. I liked the fact that Kosovo won its first gold medal in its first Olympics as an actual country. We're at the far turn now, Karen. I've seen enough gymnastics and I've seen enough swimming. It's now time for the people who run really fast.
Bring it on. Olympic golf is back for the first time in 112 years. Team Great Britain golfer Justin Rose celebrated by making a hole-in-one on Thursday. It was the first in Olympic history, but there's no medal for hole-in-one. Don't you think there should be?
Well, they should give him a car or, you know, free dinner at the clubhouse like we do in charity tournaments. It's stupid to have golf in the Olympics. Can
yes.
we at least admit it? But at least on this course, there are like giant rodents called capybaras running around and also snakes and perhaps crocodiles. You know, that would get me to watch every week on Sunday, actually, if there were wildlife all over the courses.
Also on this course are Brazilian golf fans with fans in quotes who don't seem to know the rules. I guess one of them doesn't know not to touch the ball when it goes out of bounds.
Yeah, it's not baseball. You don't get to keep it if the ball comes near you. The guy has to play it again. But I think he was trying to rescue the ball from a wild capybara myself.
The Dallas Cowboys wanted to wear a helmet decal this season in support of Dallas police officers. The NFL has said no because apparently it's vitally important to the game of football that all the helmets match. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, pretty much. But you know what? Do it anyway. Pay the fine. And then do it the next week and pay that fine. And continue to make Roger Goodell look like the idiot that he is.
NFL coaches are paid a lot. They can buy nice stuff like maybe mattresses and pillows. So what's up with L.A. Rams head coach Jeff Fisher?
Well, he's sleeping on an air mattress at training camp. This is not the first time this has happened to Jeff Fisher. He was the coach when the Houston Oilers moved to Tennessee and became the Tennessee Titans. But they played their first 2 years in Memphis while training in Nashville, because their stadium in Nashville wasn't built yet. And the first time I ever met Jeff Fisher, he was living in his trailer at the unfinished training site in Nashville. I walked in, and his socks were drying on a lamp. So if there's any coach in the history of the NFL who can handle this situation, it's Jeff Fisher.
I don't know if you met Fisher's mom, but she's apparently okay with him sleeping on an air mattress. She's not okay with the language her son uses in the season premiere of HBO's Hard Knocks. So be careful, NFL coaches. Mom might be watching.
Jeff Fisher's mom might be watching, but HBO's Hard Knocks never works out well for the team that gets chosen to participate in it. I don't know why any team ever does.
Last month, Buffalo Bills running back Carlos Williams was suspended by the team for being 25 pounds overweight. He blames his pregnant fiance. What's up with that?
Yeah, apparently when his fiance was expecting their baby, she'd get up at 1 or 2 o'clock and say she wanted a snack, and he would go join her because it was the husbandly thing to do. And believe it or not, there's a diagnostic term for this. It's called Couvade syndrome, which apparently, you know, expectant fathers can get morning sickness and hormone levels and cramps similar to labor pains.
Former NBA Commissioner David Stern will be at a Las Vegas gaming conference next month to speak in favor of legalized gambling. Will this roll of the dice pay off for the NBA and other leagues?
Yeah, David Stern does not miss a trick. He's not the kind of person who's going to stand in the way of what he knows is coming inevitably anyway. He wants federal action on it. I wish him luck with that because I don't think he's ever going to get it. But I think that, you know, state by state, I think you're going to see it start rolling.
ESPN anchor John Saunders passed away this week at the age of 61. How will you remember him?
I was around a lot at the very early days of ESPN, so I got to know the basic group of anchors, including the great Bob Lee. And John was just a terrific guy. He was a hockey player, really good hockey player when he was younger. He and I would always kid about how we both had an interest in hockey and nobody else at the network did. He was a gentleman and really a terrific broadcaster, and he will be missed very, very much.
And finally, Charlie, umpires lost count of balls and strikes in the seventh inning of Wednesday's Yankees-Red Sox game, which I think means that baseball has finally come up with a good use for instant replay.
Yes, but it also means that some umpires were unable to count to three or four. And what's great is it was on a Red Sox rookie named Andrew Benintendi, who has to be wondering whether he's really in the big leagues or not at this point. Wow, I made the show. What do you mean strike five?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
When we were growing up, there was one phrase that never got us very far. Maybe my brothers would be arguing over a game of Trivial Pursuit, or maybe I'd be mad because my little sister had gotten a cute pair of new shoes and the store didn't have any in my size. One of us kids would always yell, "It's not fair," and my dad would sigh, get this look on his face, and say, "Life is not fair." It worked. I mean, how do you argue against life is not fair? But here's the thing. Don't ever try to end an argument that way when you're talking to someone from New Zealand.
Life is not fair, as it turns out, but that's why there are New Zealanders, because we will work hard to make sure it is fair. Fairness in New Zealand is so important. It is one of the things that we get worked up about all the time. And they may be the rules, but they are not fair.
That's Heather Duplessis Allen. She hosts a television show called Story. And the rules that she's talking about relate to team sports and Olympic medals. Specifically, which members of a team are given medals during the Olympics. And even more specifically, which members of the 1976 New Zealand men's field hockey team were awarded medals after winning gold in Montreal. That the team was on the medal stand at all was a big surprise.
None of our hockey teams are good enough ever really to medal. And that was part of the problem, was that they had never ever got to the medaling stage. So none of them knew the team rules.
There were a couple of rules at play here. First, there were the rules regarding substitutions.
Back in 1976, you'd have three or four subs and you could only sub twice during a game. So you'd be sparing with who you'd bring onto the field.
But there was another rule, and this one was unique to the Olympics. Only athletes who actually played in a game would get medals.
When they finally did get to the point at which the managers and the coaches were made aware, it was far too late and the games were too tight and they couldn't spare any of their players coming off.
The International Olympic Committee would reverse that rule in 2004. Now all the members of the winning teams get medals.
New Zealand in the all-white, Australia playing from the right.
If New Zealand had ever held a commanding lead in that gold medal game, they could have done what other teams did, send in their bench players just for the last minute or two. But this game was just too close, right up until the end.
Just about it, and then wait for the hooter. The match is all over. New Zealand have won the gold medal. They have beaten Australia by 1-0.
As the team celebrated their victory on the field, the coaches knew Les Wilson and Neil McLeod wouldn't be getting medals. Les Wilson and Neil McLeod knew they wouldn't be getting medals, but nobody else did.
They kept it from the rest of the team. And in a way, keeping that information from the squad ruined their experience on the dais.
So 14 proud New Zealanders step up for the victory dais to receive their gold medals.
16 players' names were on the roster. 16 players had practiced. 16 players had paid their own way to Montreal. But the old film shows 14 proud and rather confused New Zealanders, wondering why two of their teammates weren't with them.
Rather than enjoying this amazing moment, a once-in-a-lifetime moment, they just felt incredibly bad for their two team members standing on the side.
Back in the locker room, the team celebrated. They laughed and they smiled. There are photographs to prove it. Neil McLeod just had one request.
He asked to hold the medal of another player, Arthur Parkin. He held it, and at that point he broke down and just started crying.
This all happened 40 years ago, but just last spring, the men's hopes were crushed again. They were invited to a release party for a new book about the 1976 Olympic hockey team, and somehow they got the message that they were finally going to receive those gold medals.
There was high excitement about it. They got down there. The guys were invited up on stage, and they were not given the medals. They were given commemorative coins, a set of four commemorative coins. That was all they were ever going to get. But in the communication of things, it had just been confused. Les's family said it was as if this whole thing happened all over again.
Heather DePlissy Allen hadn't known about the controversy until her producer asked her to read that book.
I can remember clearly sitting on an aeroplane, a domestic flight here in New Zealand, reading it and she crying because I thought I was so touched by it and so upset on their behalf. And after that, I thought, look, you know, we have the opportunity and we have the ability to at least give it a crack on behalf of these guys. So we decided, you know, we'll see if we can get them their medals.
So did you call these two guys up and say, hey, you must want to come on my television show and talk about this?
I did. I did not expect the reception that I got. Now, Les, when I called him up, was surprised and touched, I think, by our interest and said, okay, look, you know, I'd be happy to do it. Neil, from the outset, was really opposed to us talking about it. And then he got Les on the phone and he turned Les away from the idea as well. So then I was stuck with the problem that the two men who were affected, neither of them wanted to talk to me.
Normally, Heather says, she'd just give up and move on to another story. But remember, Heather's a New Zealander, and according to her, New Zealanders get really worked up in defense of fairness. Les Wilson's wife, Christine, and daughter, Christy, were worked up over it too, and they agreed to be interviewed.
I didn't even know Dad went to the Olympics. So it was something that was we never talked about, and it wasn't until I was in primary school and one of the teachers asked me to bring his medal to school. So I sort of said, what medal?
This might be the only part of the story Christy Wilson made it through without breaking down.
I thought that they might cry a wee bit, but they cried for a long time. The entire time, so it was such a weird situation. They had said to me Les wasn't going to come to the interview, he wouldn't be there. And so when I turned up, there's Les.
Do like this. Go like that. Go on. There you go.
This
you
go. Is the Olympian, Les Wilson, go. Playing hockey with two of his grandkids.
Oh, I got it.
Les was there when we filmed with his daughter and wife. He just didn't want to go on camera.
So we sit down around a table outside. Les pulls up a chair to watch the interview. And the whole thing was just so bizarre because there were these beautiful moments where the women would, I would ask them a question about how Les felt and they would look at him. And it was the catching of the eye that would start the tears.
When her story aired on New Zealand television, Heather's co-host responded in a way that only a New Zealand television host could.
Bugger this. We need to get the medals.
With help from Barry Maister, a member of that 1976 gold medal team who's now serving on the International Olympic Committee, Heather and her producer wrote a letter to the IOC asking them to reconsider. It starts like this.
So to whom this may concern, we want to bring to your attention a story which we have been covering on our program and which is attracting a great deal of interest and support from the New Zealand public and from our local members of the IOC.
Now, is this something you do? Do you commonly find yourself writing petition letters to the IOC or other
organizations? I've never done anything like this. No, this is completely unusual. Our jobs as journalists is not to decide the truth. It is to portray both sides of the story. But in this case, I think, you know, we decided that this just needed to be addressed just one more time.
Heather sent her letter a little over a month ago, and the IOC has already responded. The answer was no. The rules at the time prevail, the IOC says. But Heather isn't giving up so easily. She says she'll keep fighting. Although he wouldn't talk on camera for her story, Heather says Les Wilson has been privately very supportive of her efforts to get the IOC to change its mind. And he seems to be growing more comfortable talking about what happened back in 1976. He's even recently borrowed a gold medal from one of his teammates to show to his grandkids. But the other player, Neil McLeod, well, he's another story.
I mean, I'm being completely honest with you and Frank when I say that I think that Neil McLeod actually resents our attempts. He is quite unfriendly. His whole family is quite unfriendly to me.
Heather wonders if maybe Neil doesn't believe that he deserves a gold medal. But no matter, she says, she believes he deserves one.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get these guys their medals and if we could actually see his reaction? It would be certainly one of the highlights of my journalistic career if that was able to happen, because the man feels so hurt by it. He won't even pose for photographs with other people's medals on his chest, you know. So if he could have his own to pose with, I think that would be wonderful.
I think he might pose then.
I think he might pose too, and I will take that picture and stick it on television.
Heather DePlissy Allen wants to keep this story going. She thinks the fact that an American radio show was interested will inspire her viewers to join the letter-writing campaign. So Heather's producer sent me a couple of questions to answer on camera after our interview. The last question was, will you consider writing to the IOC yourself regarding the medals? I had to be honest. My dad also taught me not to lie. As a journalist, writing to the IOC is something I'm just not comfortable with. But I told Heather, maybe there are listeners of this show who get all worked up over fairness, and maybe some of them would like to write a letter. If you're such a person, you can find out how at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ian Foster. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from story co-host Duncan Garner.
Bugger this. We need to get the medals.
That was worth repeating, wasn't it? I'm Karen Given. We'll return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.